And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And now we're going to get on to our commentary for today. This week's commentary is by Lester R. Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. Lester's commentary is actually news more than commentary. It's "This Year May Be the Second Warmest on Record." Global temperature data for the first 10 months of 2001 indicate that it is likely to be the second warmest year since record-keeping began in 1867. Following the all-time high of 1998, this year's near record extends a strong trend of rising temperatures that began in the late 1970s. The 15 warmest years since 1867 have all come since 1980. This additional year of temperature data provides further evidence that a new trend of rising temperatures is bringing an end to the period of relative climate stability that has prevailed since shortly after the last ice age ended and agriculture began some 11,000 years ago. Monthly global temperature data compiled by NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in a series based on meteorological station estimates going back to 1867 show that September 2001 was the warmest September on record. August and October temperatures in 2001 were each the second warmest on record. Based on data for the first 10 months, the global average temperature for 2001 is calculated at 14.51 degrees Celsius, or about 58.1 degrees Fahrenheit. The all-time high in 1998 was 14.68 degrees Celsius. Looking back over the last century, the average global temperature climbed from 13.88 degrees Celsius in 1899 to 1901 to 14.45 degrees in 1999 and 2001, an increase of 0.57 degrees. Fully two-thirds of this gain in temperature, or more than four-tenths of a degree, occurred in the century's two closing decades. After fluctuating around 14 degrees Celsius, 57.2 degrees Fahrenheit, during most of the century, the temperature has been above this level every year since 1976. During the past several years, the Earth's temperature has fluctuated around 14.4 to 14.6 degrees Celsius. The rise of nearly six-tenths of a degree Celsius during the last century is quite small compared with the projected temperature rise over the next century of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius. That's 2.5 to 10.5 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Even the lower figure in that range would be more than double the increase of the last century. The upper end projection of 5.8 degrees Celsius would be nearly 10 times as much. The contrast in sea level rise for the last century and that projected for this one is similarly worrying. During the last century, sea level rose an estimated 0.1 to 0.2 meters, that's 4 to 8 inches. The IPCC projects that during this century, sea level will rise from 0.1 to 0.9 meters, that's anywhere between 4 and 36 inches. The temperature rise of recent decades follows on the heels of rising atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, or CO2, the principal greenhouse gas responsible for global warming. During the first two centuries of the Industrial Revolution, from 1760 to 1960, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels climbed from an estimated 277 parts per million to 317 parts per million, a rise of 40 parts per million. But during the four decades from 1960 to 2001, CO2 concentrations climbed from 317 parts per million to 371 parts per million, a gain of 54 parts per million. This accelerating rise in recent decades corresponds closely with the growth of fossil fuel burning during this period. Rising temperature is not an irrelevant abstraction. It brings countless physical changes, from more intense heat waves, more severe droughts and ice melting, to more powerful storms like the tornado in Watsonville, more destructive floods and rising sea levels. These changes in turn affect not only such obvious things as food security and the habitability of low-lying regions, but also the species composition of local ecosystems. Agriculture is particularly vulnerable to climate change. For example, in the summer of 1988, record heat and drought in the American Midwest pulled the U.S. grain harvest below the consumption for the first time in history. Fortunately for scores of countries that import grain from the United States, the nation had a large grain reserve at the time and was able to satisfy importers' needs by drawing down those reserves. Climate change affects food security in many ways. In 2000, the World Bank published a map of Bangladesh showing a 1 meter rise in sea level would inundate half of that country's rice lands. Bangladesh would lose not only half its rice supply, but also the livelihoods of a large share of its population. The combination of a population of 134 million expanding by 2.7 million a year and a shrinking cropland base is not a reassuring prospect for Bangladeshis. Climate change is also triggering widespread changes in ecosystems. Recent years have brought heavy investments by governments and environmental organizations to protect particular ecosystems by converting them into parks or reserves. But if the rise in temperature cannot be checked, there is not an ecosystem on Earth that can be saved. Everything will change. An additional year of temperature data reinforces the concerns expressed by the team of eminent scientists who produced the latest IPCC report, Climate Change 2001. They make clear what is now becoming obvious to even non-scientists, that fossil fuel burning is changing the Earth's climate. The bottom line is that altering the Earth's climate is a serious business, not something to be taken lightly. We can curb climate change by shifting from carbon-based economies to one based on hydrogen. We now have the technologies to do it. The economics are falling into place. At issue is whether we can restructure the energy economy before climate change spirals out of control. Sonar kills whales. The Navy finally admits it. The U.S. Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service have released a report acknowledging the role the Navy's experimental sonar played in the deaths of 17 marine mammals in the Bahamas last year. The report is the agency's first official admission that sonar may have contributed to whale beachings. The interim report finds the March 2000 stranding of 16 whales and a dolphin on Bahamian beaches was caused by the unusual combination of several contributory factors acting together. In other words, they blew it. The Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service concluded that the presence of whales in a restrictive ocean channel during calm water conditions, which can reflect and amplify sounds, caused the Navy's sonar to damage the whales' ears, leading them to beach themselves. A review of passive acoustic data ruled out volcanic eruptions, landslides, and other seismic events and explosive blasts, the agencies reported. The unusual extended use of Navy mid-range tactical sonars operating in the area is the most plausible acoustic source. The report says the Navy's experimental low-frequency active sonar, which has been implicated in other whale strandings, was not involved in that incident. Instead, the whales were injured because the calm water and underwater topography concentrated sound in the top 200 meters of the ocean, just where the whales and dolphins would have been swimming. The calm seas did little to stop the reflection and caused fewer air bubbles, which dissipate sound energy, the report noted. On March 15th and 16th of the year 2000, 9 Cuvier's beaked whales, 3 Blainville's beaked whales, 2 unidentified beaked whales, and 1 spotted dolphin and 2 minke whales were reported stranded along the northeast and northwest province channels on the Bahamian Islands. The strandings took place within 24 hours of the intensive use of active mid-range sonar by U.S. Navy ships as they passed through the northeast and northwest province channels. The Navy says that multiple sonar units were used over an extended period of time. 6 of those whales died after stranding on the beaches. 1 dolphin stranded and died of unrelated causes, and 10 whales were returned to the sea alive. Specimen samples were collected from 4 of the dead whales. 3 of these whales showed signs of bleeding in the inner ears, and 1 whale showed signs of bleeding around the brain. Whale biologists determined the most likely cause of bleeding was either a blow to the head or exceptionally loud noises. The investigation team concludes that tactical mid-range frequency sonars aboard U.S. Navy ships that were in use during a sonar exercise in question were the most plausible source of this acoustic or impulse trauma, the report concludes. The investigation team recommended that future research focus on identifying where combinations of ocean and undersea conditions might combine to create similar problems in the future. This research, along with other research on the impacts of sonar sounds on marine mammals, increased knowledge of marine mammal densities, increased knowledge of causes of beaked whale strandings, increased knowledge of beaked whale anatomy, physiology, and medicine, and further research on sonar propagation will provide valuable information for determining which combinations of factors are most likely to cause another mass stranding event, they conclude. The team recommended that the Navy continue to investigate how sonar affects marine mammals and develop measures to protect animals to the maximum extent possible and not jeopardize national security. The Navy said it will include, when possible, Bahamian scientists and other qualified individuals in future surveys involving marine mammal research in Bahamian territorial waters. And we want to thank Kat Lazaroff of the Environment News Service for that story. City-backed gas project threatens the Peruvian Amazon. A remote region of the Peruvian Amazon may soon be the site of a $2.7 billion gas project. The Camasi project will be located in Peru's lower Urubamba region, a biological rich area that is home to several uncontacted indigenous tribes. They won't stay that way for long. Construction of the project is slated to begin in early 2002, with equipment expected to arrive in the area at any time. The financial advisor for the Camasi project is none other than Citigroup, a notorious backer of destructive oil and gas projects around the world. According to a study by the Smithsonian Institution, the Camasi project will affect one of the world's most biologically diverse regions. The study found that the region houses more than 61 different plant species per acre, nearly 800 species of birds, 120 species of fish, 86 species of reptiles, 69 species of medium and large mammals, 300 species of small mammals, and 600 species of invertebrates. That's per acre. Researchers found the region to be in nearly pristine condition with no evidence of human activity. The lower Urubamba region is also home to the legally recognized territory of two isolated and uncontacted indigenous tribes, the Nahua and the Cagapacori. Dozens of Machichuenga communities can be found along rivers in the region. An initial environmental impact assessment found that the project's socio-cultural impacts could include loss of food resources, contamination of drinking water, loss or damage to archaeological sites, changes to existing economic activity, and the spread of disease. The project has already proven deadly for the Nahua. During preliminary exploration in the Camasi region of the 1980s, Shell exposed the Nahua to a whooping cough and influenza epidemic that killed off an estimated half of the tribe's population. Shell and Mobil, two original partners in Camasi, later withdrew from the project after investing more than $250 million. The project has been on hold since 1998 due in part to strong opposition from human rights, environmental, and indigenous groups around the world. Here's what you can do. As the financial advisor for the project, Citigroup has the important role of arranging the project's financing. With the project's start date rapidly approaching, now is the time to take a stand for the Peruvian Amazon and its inhabitants. Please write to Citigroup immediately and to end its involvement in the Camasi project. Here's the address: Mr. Sandy Weill, W-E-I-L-L, or Weill, Chief Executive Officer, Citigroup Center, 153 East 53rd Street, New York, New York. 10043. That address again for your letters to Citigroup to stop the Camasi project: Mr. Sandy Weill, Chief Executive Officer, Citigroup Center, 153 East 53rd Street, New York, New York, 10043. Or if you want to, you can send email to chris.beale, B-E-A-L-E, at citicorp.com. That's Chris, C-H-R-I-S, dot Beale, B-E-A-L-E, at citicorp.com. And we thank the Rainforest Action Network for this story. You can always check out their webpage at www.ran.org, www.rainforestactionnetwork, ran.org. War without end. In early November, as American B-52s pummeled Taliban positions, a team of United Nations scientists surveyed the wreckage of the world's last major bombing campaign, the 1999 siege of Kosovo. Since the 78-day NATO bombardment, researchers with the UN's Environment Program have scoured the fractured Balkan landscape, checking shell fragments for radioactivity, sampling well water, and testing the soil of bomb-pocked cornfields. The results of these studies are grim. The battle created severe environmental hotspots that pose acute health risks to residents of four major cities, reports UN team leader Pozny Rinnie. In the eyes of Rinnie and his fellow scientists, a new type of complex humanitarian emergency is unfolding in post-war Kosovo. A key concern for the UN is the use of depleted uranium shells, 30,000 of which were fired during the paddle for Kosovo. The United Nations fears that depleted uranium rounds, which unleash clouds of toxic, mildly radioactive uranium particles and have been dubbed Agent Orange of this era by Greens, may be contaminating drinking water in the region. Just as the ecological damage done to Kosovo has been largely ignored by the American media, few have considered the long-term environmental consequences of the conflict in Afghanistan. Military analysts expect the Pentagon to deploy DU in the Afghan theater, but in lesser amounts than in previous wars. You won't see that much depleted uranium used because there just aren't the targets, says Philip Coyle, a senior advisor at Washington, D.C.'s Center for Defense Information. Just ask Charles Cutshaw, a former Army intelligence officer and Vietnam vet. A lot of the chemicals in these weapons are toxic, explains Cutshaw, who now works as a consultant for Jane's Defense Weekly. I've seen battlefields and they are very dirty places. Even purely conventional munitions, good old-fashioned bombs and missiles, are packed with toxins that will be cast to the wind on detonation. The metal components include heavy metals like lead, a neurotoxin, and cadmium, which causes lung disease and organ damage. When you have the explosive charges, compounds like cyclonite, a probable carcinogen used in a wide range of ordnance. And don't forget perchlorates, a family of thyroid-damaging chemicals used in rocket propellants. The most significant threat, however, is probably posed by the targets hit by those weapons. In Yugoslavia, NATO bombs obliterated dozens of industrial facilities, oil refineries, electrical transformers, chemical plants, and a car factory located along the Danube River and its tributaries. The strike sent up plumes of noxious smoke and spilled hundreds of tons of hazardous chemicals into the waterways. Here, culled from a 1999 report by Pristina's Regional Environmental Center, is a brief index of the poisons dumped into the Danube River. Several hundred tons of oil, 1,000 tons of ammonia, 330 tons of caustic hydrochloric acid, and 1,400 tons of ethylene dichloride, a chemical that causes cancer in lab rats. Unsurprisingly, the result of all this was catastrophic. Dead fish were strewn along the banks of the Danube for miles. Scientists think the water contamination reached all the way to the Black Sea. The city of Pančevo, 10 miles outside Belgrade, suffered a Bhopal-type disaster when NATO planes incinerated a major petrochemical complex. The complex, which included a fertilizer factory, an oil refinery, and a chemical plant, burned for 5 days as 80,000 tons of oil and 460 tons of dioxin-laden liquid plastic went up in smoke. Rain the color of coal fell on a town of 80,000 people. The air was filled with an array of lethal chemicals, one of which, a liver poison, was clocked in at 10,000 times above safe levels, and the horror continues. According to a grisly dispatch from Pančevo that ran in the British Guardian this May, eating root vegetables is now banned because of soil contamination, dogs are coming down with a rare bone cancer, young people are reporting heart problems, and about 100 of the emergency workers who rushed to the fire are ailing from permanent disabling lung damage. Racked by 20 years of conflict, Afghanistan doesn't have the modern infrastructure of pre-war Yugoslavia, but the United States is going after the country's remaining industrial targets. In early November, the BBC reported that American bombs knocked out one of Afghanistan's biggest power plants, and in press briefings, the Pentagon says it is aiming for Taliban oil reserves and fuel depots. The cleanup problems will be extreme, says Saul Bloom, executive director of ARC Ecology, a San Francisco-based group focused on the military-environment nexus. Afghanistan as a country has no capacity to deal with the environmental impacts of this campaign, and as a result, people who aren't even born yet will be paying the price. This war will create second and third generation victims, and we want to thank A.C. Thompson of The Nation magazine for that story. And moving to other animal news, the Mississippi gopher frog has been listed as endangered. The Mississippi gopher frog, the nation's rarest amphibian, has been listed as endangered according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Mississippi gopher frog, found only at a single site in Mississippi, is a distinct population segment of a wider-ranging gopher frog. The Mississippi gopher frog has genetic characteristics that are different from all other gopher frogs and is isolated from other populations by 125 miles of unoccupied habitat and the Mobile River Delta. The Mississippi gopher frog once existed in the longleaf pine forests of the lower coastal plain from east of the Mississippi River in Louisiana to the Mobile River Delta in Alabama. It has not been seen in Louisiana since 1967 or in Alabama since 1922. Today, just 100 adult frogs remain, all located at one site in the DeSoto National Forest in Harrison County, Mississippi. Biologists believe loss and degradation of habitat is the primary reason the species has declined. The species is a unique part of a natural heritage of the South that could slide into extinction if we do not take action to protect and conserve it, said Sam Hamilton, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Southeast Regional Director. We are eager to work in partnership with the state of Mississippi, the U.S. Forest Service, and private landowners to recover the gopher frog. Because of the small number of remaining Mississippi gopher frogs, the species is vulnerable to natural processes such as drought and floods and to the loss, damage, and fragmentation of its habitat. These threats could bring about the frog's extinction. A single breeding pond is used by the frogs located in Mississippi's DeSoto National Forest, is close to a proposed 4,600-acre residential development. This development and the anticipated future urban and commercial development it will bring to the area, including several highways, could damage the frog's only remaining habitat. We are currently working with the developer to avoid potential impacts to the frog, Hamilton said. As other projects in the vicinity of the breeding pond arise, we will continue our efforts to prevent conflicts between development and the survival of the frog. And we want to thank the Environment News Service for that news. And we want to say that that's all the time we have for news on this, the last hour-long Earth First Radio news show. But if you do want to send news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio News, which will be coming up on the 7th of January, send them to cruzeef at cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. You can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more information and news about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is 3023. That's P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, that address, Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You're going to have to listen to Earth First Radio News live on your computer every Monday through Friday at 5:30 Pacific Time. You can always go to the website at www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And there's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen in anytime. You will always be able to find Earth First Radio News archived shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. And I'm going to try and put them up at www.la.indymedia.org also, but their hard drive is out of space, so I don't know what's happening with that. That's www.la.indymedia.org, and on either of those sites, search for Earth First Radio News. This final show was show number 171, and Earth First Radio News hopefully will be carried on local stations wherever you are, and of course we'll always be live on the internet. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio News starting January 7th. The show has been produced by the Earth First Radio Collective and Uncle Dennis in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you all for the many, many years you've been listening, and hopefully you'll tune in to Earth First Radio News as we continue on into the future. And we're going to head on out of here with Casey Neal off his Paw Prints CD. This is called Resistance.
There are those with good hearts who do what they feel to be right. There are those whose souls have been twisted by the power of might. For money or for stature, they hold all others down. They hope you look the other way as they tie the chains so tight. to weaken us. They numb our minds with drugs and alcohol, so we're so high we don't notice when we fall. And the TV tells us all is well, that we live in a free state. In the face of this destruction, we must retaliate. Resistance, resistance, resistance. Sing the song, sing the song, sing the song. As they tear apart the earth, they tear apart our souls. Drilling for oil, logging for lumber, and mining for coal. But the trees are not for feed, and the mountains are not for sale. And the power of a river's not a power to be controlled. They say that we need these things to live in our excess, and the scientists assure us all is well they have assessed. But behind their eyes you can cut through their lies, see that they've hidden the mess. Resistance, resistance, resistance. Sing the song, sing the song, sing the song. So if you see the truth of how they're literally killing time, you must take action against the wrongs. If you don't, it is a crime to look the other way when you know all the while that our heritage is being lost to the bottomless pockets of the slime. For the struggle of the people, for the struggle of the land, for the sake of our grandchildren, we all must understand that we must fight for our livelihood and fight for all we know, or the future will be washed away with the tides ebb and flow. Resistance, resistance, resistance. Sing the song, sing the song, sing the song. Hear the wailing of the ghosts as they walk the trail of tears. Hear the voices of Turtle Island crying for 500 years. The massacres continue since Columbus landed on the shore. You don't know what it is to live until you have something to die for. Hopeless in the hands of a higher way. Then the blood will be on your hands too, no matter what you say. For only the weak give up hope, only the weak make them strong. Rise for the love of life, rise and seize the day. Don't think that the world cannot be changed by the conviction of a few. For the life force is on our side and we will break on through. To make a world wild with glory generations down the line. Earth, justice now, it's up to me and you. Resistance, resistance, resistance. Sing the song, sing the song, sing the song. Resistance, resistance, resistance.